Welcome to a special edition of On Deadline, a deep dive into a single topic from Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. Today, we're giving you the latest on a terrifying act of political violence in Minnesota when Vance Luther Bolter allegedly opened fire at two different scenes. At one, police say he wounded State Senator John Hoffman and his wife. At the other, he's accused of fatally shooting Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark. The attack set off a complex manhunt, one that officials described as the largest in state history, that lasted nearly 2 days before Bolter was apprehended late Sunday. The U.S. Attorney's Office filed a complaint late Sunday, charging him with an array of federal charges, said Joe Thompson, the acting U.S. Attorney for the District of Minnesota. It's no exaggeration to say this is the stuff of nightmares, Thompson added. So, how did it unfold, and what was Bolter's alleged motive to gun down political leaders? Let's dive in, starting with political analyst Blois Olson at WCCO Radio in Minneapolis.
Everybody says something's got to change, and so I'm just trying to look at myself in the mirror and say, what can we change about our politics? What can we change about the tone and tenor? Because we can't go on in a democracy like this at all.
We absolutely can't. We can't. The Star Tribune has an article, like a little piece, Minnesotans wonder, is this who we are now? I want people to weigh in on this. If you want to text us to tell us what are your thoughts about what happened this weekend, how has it affected you? Are you going to do anything differently? Is this who we are? Okay, Blois, I want to play this clip. Because I remember a week ago, you had both Melissa Hortman and Lisa Damathon, and you asked them just a brilliant question at the end. And I just remember it hitting me at the time going, wow, that was a really good question. And I want to play Melissa Hortman's answer. And you played this at the top of your show yesterday. Could you just set it up for us? Because I thought it was just a really good way to find out who they are as people.
Yeah, I think the setup is the conversation you and I had for weeks. Is there going to be a deal? Is there not going to be a deal? And I knew that they were spending a lot of time together. I knew primarily from texts from Melissa Hortman how they were trying to construct this deal, even though it was my job to question it and see where it was. But I said it yesterday to Corzo. Look, it's different when women try to solve problems, plain and simple. And I could just imagine these two women in these leadership positions having gotten to know each other for hours. And that's why I asked the question.
Okay. You had an answer from Damath, but I want to play the one from Hortman where she talks about Lisa Damath.
I know you've spent a lot of time with Speaker Damath. You've known a lot of legislators. You've dealt with a lot of Republican leaders over the years. What have you learned about Speaker Damath? And is there anything the public should know? Like, what are the inside jokes between you? If you guys had a day where you didn't have to talk about the legislature, could you, like, hang out for a day and do something? And what would it be, Leader Hortman?
Well, as Leader Damath mentioned, this year got off to a rocky start. We're certainly not over it that they tried to kick out one of our members who won his election and unconstitutionally seized power until the Supreme Court ordered that they stop. But we do get along well. We have had a good working relationship. We have some of the same clothes or very similar clothes, so we do text each other to make sure we don't show up like twins. But we have very different perspectives about how state government should work. And we've been able to have a cordial relationship, even though we really disagree about how to run state government.
Oh, it's just eerie to hear her voice as well. And that question really touched me, Blois, that you were trying to get from each of them what they thought of the other. The other thing last night, I stayed up to watch the news conference last night, and Governor Walz talked about Melissa Hortman and how during negotiations, she used a book called Getting to Yes, Debating with a Sense of Goodwill. And he talked about how that was the thing that she was all about.
It's a drive. It was a mission. It was a cause for her to get to yes, to solve problems without the anger and polarization. And I felt it. And there's two or three kind of vignettes that I don't think I've talked about much. One was after I asked those questions last week, she texted me immediately after. And she said, a reminder that polling, supported this, blah, blah, blah. And I responded, if we're going by what's popular in polls, I'll take that as a note of what else could get done this session. And she said, noted, understood, because there are a lot of popular things that didn't get done. But there was a text earlier that week, and you kept asking me about the process. And, you know, you hate to reveal sources, but people know me and they should understand my process. When I sent those texts every night asking what was up, Melissa Hortman usually responded. She'd not say much, but one night last week or before the deal was cut, she actually sent me excerpts of her briefing documents. And she just said, Blaise, this is no BS. We are getting there. Here's some examples. And she's like, this is off the record, but I want you to understand we're making progress. And she just made sure that you had information. You know, it was 11:40 at night. I had gone to sleep. I woke up to those texts. And that's the kind of dialogue and relationship that she afforded so many people. Because that's what it took to get to yes. She wanted me to show some optimism on the radio, even though I was skeptical as hell. And by the way, we're all skeptical, but we have to take from this that we need more hope and less skepticism about our government and our public servants.
Well, it's a tall task for some people, though, Blaise. Gosh, you know, but
I know it is, but you ask, is this who we are?
Yeah, that's what they're asking.
It's not. It's not who we are, because I'm with neighbors, I'm with friends, I'm with people at the golf course. The majority of us are not like this.
I would hope.
No, and I know we aren't, but we have to amplify the hope and the get to yes and the, because the negativity drowns us out. And I've said this before, there's 535 members of Congress and 25 of them make all the headlines and people go crazy. And the Minnesota legislature isn't like that. And I'm glad it's not. And we can't let it get to that, because that's what really, really divides us. This has hit so many people to the core that I don't know that I could ever walk into the Capitol again with any sort of other than just kind of an optimism that we got to get to yes.
Oh, absolutely. In honor of her and her memory, getting to yes.
Vance Luther Bolter allegedly posed as a police officer to get to his victims, which raises plenty of questions. Here, former Secret Service agent Mike Olson discusses how easy it can be for someone to impersonate a police officer by obtaining the necessary equipment. There's a complex relationship between the public and law enforcement, and many are left wondering if this will change anything.
We can say all we want. Why would somebody open the door for somebody at 3 a.m? Well, if the person was dressed like a police officer and he had what looked like a cop car with flashing lights outside, we trust the police. We rely on the police. We need the police. Of course, we would answer the door. So how does this damage now the relationship between us civilians and the police? And also, how does somebody end up looking like a cop and showing up at your door? Mike Olson is a former Secret Service agent. He is the owner of 360 Security Services and somebody we rely on a lot here on the air. How could somebody look so much like a cop? What did he, you know, go to the Party City and get a uniform? Like, he really had flashing lights on his car. I saw the car being dragged away. It really looked like a cop car. I mean, Mike, how easy is it to impersonate a real police officer?
Well, it could be very easy for anybody that's got the means and the money to go out and buy the equipment and things like that. And this particular individual, it appeared he was an owner or, you know, significantly involved in a local security company. And, you know, I went to that website on Saturday to look, and there's a picture of a vehicle right on there that appeared to be almost an exact match minus the door decals for what appears to be the same model as a typical police Ford Explorer.
Mike, when you said you went to the website, as you from a security standpoint, somebody who provides security for high-level people, when you look at what you know about this case right now, does anything jump out to you? Because Giordano, you know, like she said, and like the fact the guy shows up in the middle of the night impersonating a police officer, I think up until that point, a majority of Americans would open the door. From your standpoint and how you assess this, take us through that process, what you think about in this case.
Sure. So I think this goes a little bit beyond the typical, act violence that involves maybe somebody who's, you know, suffering from some type of stressor in their life, mental health mm-hmm. issue. That's typically what you see, especially in, you know, school active shooting, your average active shooter scenarios in public places. What was apparent here was a significant amount of what appeared to be planning and preparation for this. And not only that, there appeared to be some level of plan for escape. That or he got darn lucky with how events unfolded early Saturday morning.
So how do we rebuild the trust? Or should these kind of, you're in security. Should these kind of uniforms, should these kind of props really that make you look like a police, should they be allowed in private security?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, I don't have the law in front of me, but according to Minnesota state law, there are requirements that private security cannot have certain color uniforms, and they cannot have certain color vehicles. So that is a difference between what you'll typically see in law enforcement and what you would see in private security. But that doesn't mean people don't go out there and like I said, buy uniforms. I mean, there was always a concern about that when I was in the Secret Service. We'd reports of theft of uniforms, prior to big events and things like that. And so it can happen. What's important is that, you know, everybody at all levels learns from these incidents and pays attention to them, thinks about what their personal plan is going to be in the future if something like that were to happen. One of the things law enforcement is increasingly putting out is, not to hesitate to call 911 and to ensure if there's a legitimate reason for somebody to be at your door. Unfortunately, that is important, but it could mean a delay in services, depending on the scenario. In the middle of the night, like this, that is, I think it's an important thing. And, one of the things we try to teach, certain people we work with is, especially if you have Ring door cameras mm-hmm. or cameras, use those to your advantage. Do not open that door. I mean, the assassination of Judge Salas out in New Jersey several years ago, son that answered the door for the FedEx driver. Another example of that is, you want to have as much time to react as you can, and having those cameras on the outside of your house, being able to observe that and make a decision or not to answer the door, call the police immediately, get them in, have a plan ahead of time. But all of that is extremely important. And, the one thing that struck me on Saturday, which was scary, is in the immediate aftermath of the events, the police were done, putting out that, we'll only have two people approach mm-hmm. the door. And that's great. And that was good for in that moment. But the problem is in the reality with, police staffing shortages and things like that is going forward, you are going to have circumstances or incidents where there's only one police officer coming to address a situation, or is, stopping somebody for some type of traffic infraction. And so, you can get on the call 911, stay calm, and ask for guidance to get through it and to assess. We had a family event yesterday, and I was just talking with my in-laws who had a unusual incident just a couple of weeks ago, my brother-in-law, where they were followed out of a particular town here in the Twin Cities, and they couldn't figure it out. They finally called 911 and got instruction to vector them into the West St. Paul Police Department. And, thankfully, the police were waiting, and sure enough, it was a person extremely high on drugs, and for whatever reason they can't explain, had decided to follow them through four cloverleaf changes. I mean, it's crazy. So, but the point being is, people can't be afraid to call the police and clarify things and ask for help, and then follow those instructions carefully.
I totally agree. I just want to ask a follow-up question. Mike, we're speaking with Mike Olson, former Secret Service agent and the owner of 360 Security Services here in Minnesota. Mike, you said have a plan. Now, I thought about this horrific crime that was committed. Clearly, the shooter shot the person who opened the door. But then the second person, who must have maybe still been in the bed, you know, was hearing this. If somebody comes to your door and shoots the member of your family that opens the door, what is the plan? What should be the plan? I mean, what can you even do? Or are we at that point sitting ducks?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it does kind of dictate on, you know, why would you be being targeted? Is there a risk to you based on your profession, based on your status, wealth, VIP, you know, whatever the circumstances are? And, you know, typically, if you look at the big picture of events that go on in the world, you know, certain people are more prone to potentially being targeted for this. You know, separate of a workplace violence issue where it's a disgruntled, you know, fellow employee or some sort of romance gone bad in the workplace, you do have to think through that. And you don't want to be paranoid, but you have to visualize what you would do in these scenarios. And in the specific one you just asked, Jordana, I would want to be teaching my family, you don't come down. You barricade yourself further into the house. You have a phone with you and nearby when you go to sleep so that you can get 911 on its way, even to dial 911 and keep it on, you know, from disconnecting, keep it off the hook, so to speak. All very important things. But, you know, one of the most helpful things I got, I was a police officer for a short period of time in the late 90s in St. Paul. And prior to that, going through training, one of the most helpful pieces of training advice we got as police officers was to always visualize what you're responding to. So when that call comes out, what are all the potential scenarios that you could envision? And the more you program your mind to think that way, you know, whether you're in a movie theater, whether you're at the gas station and you're pulling out your credit card, you know, don't be paranoid, but visualize, what would I do if somebody did X, Y, or Z? And you create a muscle memory by doing that. You create some level of memory from going through those exercises so that you have the ability to react quicker in crisis, because in crisis, you know, our fine motor skills diminish if we don't go through that those experiences a lot.
But what kind of person makes the rest of us have to learn vigilance to avoid being the object of an unprovoked violent attack? Eric Nisbet, professor of policy analysis communications at Northwestern University, discusses political violence and how, in the absence of clear information, people tend to fill the gaps with partisan narratives and explanations that align with their own biases. This often leads to the spread of misinformation, and then it can become a vicious cycle. Here's more from the Tommy Tucker Show in New Orleans.
Talk about what happened in Minnesota, because, you know, I got a text from some people that were very conservative, and they were talking about blood on the hands, and I didn't understand the whole thing because it was a Democrat that shot a Democrat. Not that that is inconsequential, but other people were texting me about, this proves about guns. It seems as though when something like this happens, people already, before they even know the details, are already assigning blame to this one or that one or the other one.
Right. Well, I think it's unclear really what was the political orientation of the attacker. You know, in Minnesota, you don't register with a party. So he was not registered as Republican or Democrat, even though he had been appointed by Democratic governors to some state boards. But it also seems that he might be experiencing some mental illness, personal circumstances. So it's really unclear what the motivations were. He was an outspoken advocate against abortion, for example, it seems, appearing in the news. Mm-hmm. He had spent time in Africa. He had relayed some sermons against gay and trans lifestyles while in Africa. So it was unclear, really. He seemed to have like a heterodox sort of political orientation combined with some mental illness issues and personal circumstances. That's really hard to unpack really what motivated these attacks.
Well, the reason I brought up Democrat was that somebody said that Tim Walz had appointed him to some kind of housing board or something like that. And for whatever reason, they were blaming Tim Walz for this. Do you know anything about that?
Right. There was a lot of misinformation about the fact that Tim Walz and a previous Democratic governor had appointed him to the board. The likelihood that Tim Walz or the Democrat even know this person. You know, governors make a lot of appointments for whatever reason to various boards of one sort of another, often not even knowing who the person is. It's handled by staff. And so I think making a direct linkage to Tim Walz is really sort of false or misleading. You know, a lot of different people from different backgrounds serve on state boards, both Republican and Democrat, and can be appointed for various reasons. So,
and I'm not, I'm not defending Tim Walz or I'm not blaming Tim Walz. The only thing I don't understand, I couldn't understand how that had anything to do with anything, how a government employee, a government appointee to an obscure housing board, seemingly an obscure housing board, how that in any way had anything to do with a nut job taking up a gun and assassinating people. Am I missing something?
Same thing. It was a lot of false misleading. I mean, this often unfortunately happens when motivations are unclear. There's a lack of information because it was emerging. I think the fact that it coincided with the No Kings, I saw online when I was, we were monitoring the social media chatter about the protests on Saturday as part of a project. And we saw a lot of people were calling him the No Kings killer, for example, on the right, linking it to the No Kings protest. So I think there was a lot of, unfortunately, people were taking the opportunity to frame this sometimes as an attack against the Democrats or the left or the No Kings protest and linking it to them as a way to discredit.
Well, and that's what I was having a hard time understanding. And again, people can believe whatever they want, but I don't know how you blame Tim Walz for a guy that's got conservative viewpoints, because that would be anything but Tim Walz, right?
Right. And I don't think if you look at this individual's history of comments and of behaviors and activities and say it's a clear-cut, you know, case of a Democrat attacking a Democrat, I think a lot of more information needs to emerge. It seems that he has a range of views, some of them that align possibly on some cases on the left and some cases on the right. And honestly, that's how, I mean, I think we overestimate often. We have a lot of polarization in this country, but there's a lot of people who I would call heterodox views. They have some views that clearly align with the right and some views that clearly align with the left. And I think it's hard sometimes to like pigeonhole people into one or the other. And, you know, in this case, it's unclear what these motivations were and attacking these elected officials.
Professor, you taught me a new word, heterodox. What does that mean?
Heterodox views means it's like you have a diverse range of views. You're not clearly left. You're not clearly right. You're not clearly aligned with one camp or another, right? You have views that go against both sides, right? It's a mix. So I think, you know, and there is actually a movement among some educators, politicians, to promote heterodoxy, right? Not to basically pigeonhole people as purely left or right or liberal or conservative, because most people have a range of views that might surprise people in terms of not necessarily agreeing 100% with Democrats, 100% with Republicans.
It just seems like, again, after any kind of shooting like this, you can go back and make it about whatever you want it to be, depending on what your cause is. You can make it about how did a nut job like this get a gun to begin with, right? You can make it about political speech. You can make it about anything you want. And now we don't really know what the hell happened other than he's in custody, correct?
Right. And that's the thing. Like when there's a lack of information, there wasn't a clear manifesto posted. There wasn't a clear announcement or understanding of the motivation of the attacks, why these people were targeted, or what this person's background was. It's still emerging. They're still investigating. And so that creates an opportunity for people, especially online, to fill in those gaps because people want to know. People have this need for cognitive closure. They want to know. They want to understand something. They want to make sense of something. And when you present sometimes very overly simplistic explanations, people latch onto those because that fills that gap, especially when there's a information vacuum. And so I think that's what's been happening the last few days.
Has the time frame shortened on that, where now people want to know immediately why and who and what and all that?
Sure, there is no patience, right? And I think also it's not only a time frame has happened in general. We have these like 24-hour news cycles where something happened 24 hours ago. It's old news. even less, 12 hours, 6 hours, right? The other thing is, I think people, we do live in a more polarized country online. And so you have very polarized information sources on the left, on the right, influencers, news, person news, that basically will spin this to the most sort of partisan frame possible for their sort of political advantage. And then people latch on to these explanations because it aligns with their prior beliefs or partisanship. And so it's consistent information. And we like consistency, right? So we find an explanation that's consistent with our biases, we're going to latch on to it.
A detailed 20-page complaint filed by federal prosecutors today reveals chilling details about the actions early Saturday by Vance Bolter, the suspect in targeted political shootings that have left former Minnesota Speaker of the House Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark dead, and State Senator John Hoffman and his wife seriously injured. Federal prosecutors say that after shooting Hoffman and his wife early Saturday morning, Bolter drove to an unnamed state representative's home in Maple Grove, Minnesota, still dressed as a police officer wearing a tactical vest, body armor, armed with a gun, and wearing a mask. That representative was not home. Bolter then drove to a state senator's home in New Hope, where he encountered a police officer who attempted to speak with him. According to the officer, he just sat there and stared straight ahead. That's when Belter drove to the home of Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman and her husband, where he killed them after briefly exchanging gunfire with police. Officials say it's clear the shootings were politically motivated and was a, quote, targeted attack against individuals who answered the call to public service. Here's more reaction from the Adam and Jordana show at WCCO in Minneapolis.
It's not about hatred. It's not about mean tweets. It's not about demeaning someone. It's leading with grace and compassion and vision and compromise and decency. That was taken from us in Minnesota with the murder of Speaker Hortman. So for each and every one of us to truly honor, and we will continue to honor that spirit, but we will need to do it in just more than actions in a memorial. Conducting ourselves in the spirit that Melissa Hortman did her work is what the country needs to heal.
And will Minnesotans, will our country hear those words and take them to heart after an awful, awful, horrifying weekend in Minnesota? Adam and Jordana, good morning.
Good morning.
We will devote much of the show, if not all of the show, to the events over the weekend, including, as we mentioned, a press conference coming up at 10 o'clock with Mary Moriarty at Hennepin County, where presumably she'll announce these charges against Vance Bolter. I just trying to process what happened on Saturday and go through the emotions of what took place. You know, I think we say this all the time. Doesn't happen here. I mean, everybody says that when any kind of crime happens anywhere. But I think in Minnesota, we always feel differently about, boy, we're better than this. And we're not. I mean, this scary as it is, frightening, the sad thing I took away from this, and not in the method and the just sadistic nature of this crime, but the fact that there was political violence, sadly, I was not shocked at all. And I think that's awful for me to say, but in this day and age, it's like a train that's been moving this direction, and we've been not able to do anything about it. So that part of the story sadly didn't shock me. And going back to the question we heard there from Governor Walz, will we check our temperature? Will we tone it down? I hate to be cynical, but I sure as hell hope so, but I don't know. I mean, I hope so. Do you feel any differently? I mean, did you have that reaction? I mean, you and I talk about this all the time, about how the temperature has been so hot now, and things are not like they used to be. And I know that's a cliche, but they're not. The actions of one guy, and I'm not saying that, I'm not pinpointing this on anybody else, but the collective we, and that we have caused this to get too hot, and we need to do something about it before this happens again.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say, I am so sorry. I am sorry to the families
of the Hortmans and the Hoffmans. I am sorry to the colleagues. I am sorry to Minnesotans and Americans that this happened. I feel devastated, like most Minnesotans, most people who follow politics. I am so sad that this has happened, not only in our country, in our backyard. When I found out about this Saturday morning, my first text was to David because he lives in Brooklyn Park. And I needed to make sure that his family was okay. And that I said, are you in lockdown? Are the kids okay? Are they inside? You know, David was half a mile outside of the radius of the lockdown. But immediately you think about your friends and loved ones. But Melissa Hortman was one of those people because we all knew her. And Adam, to respond to your question, I am not surprised in the least. I often say on this show, our culture is set by what we're willing to tolerate. We are absolutely willing to tolerate gun violence in this country.
Yep.
We are absolutely willing to tolerate protests that include violence, which we assume the alleged shooter was protesting against some kind of policies, some kind of political agenda. Again, more to reveal, he has not been convicted of anything. He's still the alleged assassin. But we are tolerant of this. We have created a culture where violence against people that you don't agree with is not only allowed, but accepted. And once we start standing against that is not a way to solve our differences. We should work through diplomacy when it comes to these political disagreements and understand that shooting someone is not the way to get your agenda pushed through in this country. That is not what we do here.
And
well, it's supposed to be not what we do here, but unfortunately it is what we do
here. And here's the thing too. And I forget who made this quote. One of the officials who was quoted this weekend said that we can all, and our reaction shouldn't be, well, you can blame the other side because they've been doing this. It's up to us to check ourselves and to check people who agree with us, not the people. It's easy to criticize and easy to throw stones at someone who disagrees with you. But it's the people who on your side who get too vociferous or say something that is crossing the line. That takes courage to do, to say, hey, we're better than this. We need to stop this. And it takes both sides to do that. And God, I hope that the words, which are the right words we've been hearing from state officials of both parties who have decried this violence, have called it out, saying it's not tolerable. I hope those statements and those feelings continue a week from now, 2 weeks from now, a month from now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't think we accept violence. I really don't. I mean, you can argue that we don't do a damn thing about it, and that might be viewed as acceptance, but I still feel that this country, we don't accept this. We don't accept political assassinations. And the proof will be in our actions now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time to take those actions so that we say, no, this isn't us. It shouldn't be anybody, but it sure as hell isn't America.
I hope not. I fear that we have devolved into a society that shoots people when we disagree with them politically. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have because of what was evidenced this past weekend. I mean, you haven't. I haven't. No. David hasn't. Our listeners haven't, God willing. But
and I still feel it. 99.9%. Yeah. Again, this is one guy. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard an interview. Vanita, by the way, had a great interview with Mark Burley.
We'll share some of that again.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the fact that it sure seems that Vance Belter had some help to elude authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily had some help leading up to the crime, but possibly after the crime. So those people, if he was helped, need to be held accountable and brought to justice.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But I'm not willing to say just, and as terrible as they are, I don't know how many more people are out there that would actually take that action.
I would agree with you because we don't see politicians getting shot every day at their homes. You're right. So this is, I'm not going to say an isolated incident, mm-hmm. but it is an incident that's not happening every day. Mm-hmm. So maybe we have not devolved into that. And of course, it remains to be seen how this will be handled, a plan of action against the alleged shooter. So I just have a sense of sadness for people. My stepdaughter called me. She was on the way. She was going to work on Saturday, and she called me when she was listening to the radio about all of this. And she says, you know, what's going on? What's the inside scoop? And I said to her, she's in her 30s, I said, I'm sorry that you have to live in a world where this happens. I mean, she lives in Plymouth. It's right close to, you know, where this happened. I said, I'm so sorry that this is happening in your time. I feel like, you know, things have always been divisive in this country. Things have always been dangerous. But I often ask people that are older than me, has it ever been this bad? And in the 60s, it was bad. I know things were bad. People were getting assassinated, JFK, Martin Luther King. I understand. But the divisiveness that I see now, and I apologized to her. I said, I'm just so sorry that you have to live through this and raise your children through this right now. And Adam, what... We can't look back on what led up to this, but what do we do now? Mm-hmm. Can we wipe the slate clean and really start over saying, okay, I'm going to listen to the other side. I'm not going to be so hateful. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to listen to pundits on the TV that rile me up about, you know, fake outrage, mm-hmm. you know, faux activism. What do we do now from here to tone the temperature down? It's this rhetoric that has gotten us into trouble. You know, people are blaming Walls for calling, you know, Trump the SS or a Nazi. Like, I get it. There's been terrible rhetoric. But friends, we can't go back. We can't blame President Biden for this. We're not looking back. Now it's time. Wow, this is happening. Is this who we want to be? Is this how we want to live? If not, we collectively, you, me, Adam, David, you sitting at home, have the opportunity to make a change. How do we do it? Mm-hmm.
Reacting to the weekend, the horrific events of the weekend, Melissa Hortman shot and killed, her husband Mark shot and killed, John Hoffman, his wife Yvette, also shot. Miraculous that they survived, considering how many times they were shot, and hopefully they will make a full recovery.
And his wife Yvette, heroically, we are hearing, you know, threw herself over her disabled daughter. We know that Senator Hoffman was an advocate for disabled people's rights, threw herself over her disabled daughter and took 8 bullets, I believe. Yeah. Extraordinary that they have survived. And she has since been texting Amy Klobuchar. I mean, what an unbelievable hero to think of that in the moment when you must be hearing your husband being shot and fearing for your own life. Just amazing heroism.
Getting a lot of texts asking why it isn't first-degree murder charges. And obviously, Mary Moriarty, a Hennepin County attorney. But it works this way. You initial charges are second-degree murder because you need a grand jury to indict someone on first-degree murder. I have no doubt, considering the level of planning, that Vance Belter is going to be charged with first-degree murder. Mm-hmm. But you need a grand jury to indict someone on first-degree murder charges. So you make the initial charge of second-degree murder. So I know people are wondering, well, why isn't he charged with first-degree murder? I totally get that, but you need a grand jury to indict someone
on first-degree
murder. Thank you,
and good questions, and thank you for explaining that, and he probably will be. Yeah. What do? We have free speech in this country. People get to say whatever they want, almost without impunity, until it reaches an extraordinarily high level of incitement to violence. I mean, how do you tell the president or the governor or anybody on either side of the aisle to be nicer?
Negative political ads, which are, well, they work, so that's why we keep doing them. Well, let's stop. Let's make it so they don't work anymore.
That's on us.
All right.
That's what we got to look in the mirror right now.
Thank you for listening to today's On Deadline. The show is produced by Christy Strausser and Lauren Barry. Subscribe for more episodes wherever you get your podcasts.